because we absolutely felt that this was the literal thing we had to do, to put ourselves in front of a train, to say, we will not take this anymore.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Abby Brockway, co-defendant in Delta 5 case, and Tim DeChristopher, founder of the Climate Disobedience Center. And we'll post online an interview with Tim DeChristopher about the Oregon standoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, January 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Freedom on My Mind, How Voting Rights Were Won in Mississippi, with post-film Poetic Justice, open mic poetry event with poet and MC John Slaughter. Freedom on My Mind chronicles the complex and compelling history of the Mississippi voter registration struggles of 1961 to 1964. The interracial nature of the campaign, the tensions and conflicts, the fears and hopes. Again, that's Freedom on My Mind, Thursday, January 14th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running through February 8th. Real Music explores the live interplay between sound and image, music and culture. Saturday, January 16th will be The Theory of Obscurity, a film about the residents, released in 2015. Don Hardy's film tells the story of the group's start in rural Louisiana, its artistic awakening in the late 60s San Francisco, and follows its members to present day, where they are all still actively creating and performing. That's January 16th at 9:30 p.m. at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there's a public hearing tomorrow in Clark County on plans to build the Tesoro Savage Oil Terminal along the Columbia River in Vancouver, Washington.
Immigrant rights groups, along with labor, faith, families, and members of Congress, held a news conference in front of the White House today to demand an end to the immigration raids.
And the Supreme Court heard a case today that could overturn union protections for hundreds of thousands of workers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 11th, 2016. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Ken Jones. The Supreme Court heard a case today that could have wide-ranging implications for union members across the country. Several conservative judges on the court have made statements indicating they would rule against the unions. But although arguments were heard today, a decision won't be issued for several months. Since 1977, the court has said non-union employees can be required to pay a portion of union dues to cover the cost of collective bargaining and prevent free riders. Those are workers who get the benefits of a union contract without paying for it. Now, in a case brought by non-union teachers in California hoping to get the earlier decision overturned, the justices are asked to decide whether even that requirement violates free expression. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Ken Zinn from National Nurses United for more on this story.
Why is the NNU staging a demonstration outside the Supreme Court chambers today?
We were there this morning because the court was hearing the case Friedrichs versus CTA, which is an attempt by far-right-wing anti-union groups to try to weaken public sector unions and the labor movement as a whole. And given that we represent many nurses, we're the largest registered nurse organization in the country, we felt the need to speak out in defense of our rights on the job as well as to stand up for our right to advocate for our patients.
Many of the friend of the court filings, also known as amicus briefs, they cite a case known as Abrud versus Detroit. Can you share your understanding of that case and how it applies to the matter before the court today?
Well, I'm not a lawyer and don't want to pretend to be one, but the established law on this instance is that states have the right to have laws that mandate what are called agency fees for public sector workers in the case where those employees have decided to be in a union, so that even those who don't want to support the work of the union are still required to pay these agency fees to make sure that the union has the financial resources necessary to defend them. Under the labor law, unions are required to represent employees whether they are union members or not. So that's the basis of this, is that even those who choose not to be union members need to pay these agency fees because the union has a legal requirement to defend them. And this way, they can have the financial resources to do so. And so that established law, which has been case law for a number of years, is what is up for question now in this current case of Friedrichs.
And what are you hearing about action on the ground in D.C. in terms of how many folks were present there this morning?
Well, I was there personally. Say there were about 500 people out there who were demonstrating to support their union and to support the labor movement and to call on the court to not overturn the existing law, the existing precedent.
The petitioners in this case are proponents of something called a right-to-work principle. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's the euphemism, right-to-work. It's not a phrase that we would use, but it's the phrase that the right-wing uses, which is an effort in the private sector to have state laws passed that, again, similar to the issue in this case, not require workers who are in organized, unionized shops to have to pay these agency fees.
Should the court decide in favor of the petitioner, will more than public sector workers with the Teachers Association of the state of California be impacted?
Yes, so it would affect all public sector workers, state, county, municipal employees around the country. Already federal employees are subjected to this same concept. It's called open shop. So that already exists in the federal sector. The question is whether states have the right to, on their own, mandate that agency fees be paid. And it wouldn't directly affect the private sector unions, but certainly if public sector unions are negatively impacted, it certainly has a spillover effect on private sector workers as well.
I was just hoping to get a handle on how many people can potentially be impacted by what the court decides.
It's in the millions.
And based on the press release that I found from your organization, there's 20 of 24 key measures that affect public health and safety, and right to work has been in place in some states that you've had an opportunity to assess its impact.
Well, in the so-called right-to-work states, which is now about half the states in the country are right-to-work, and what happens is because the whole purpose of right-to-work is to weaken or obliterate unions, those particular states that have so-called right-to-work rank lower on any number of indices regarding poverty rates for children, infant mortality, any number of health indicators like cardiovascular death, infant mortality, infectious disease control, etc. And so again, as registered nurses, this is a primary concern to us. And then in addition, you know, the ability of nurses to advocate for their patients really depends on whether they have the protection of a union. In hospital after hospital all over the country, nurses are browbeaten by managers, and the ability of patients who enter hospitals to seek care is totally dependent on whether they've got a registered nurse at their bedside who will advocate for them. And that is under threat. In this court case, in public sector hospitals, it's under threat in states that have so-called right to work.
When do you expect the court to announce a decision on this issue of this case?
We don't really know. I mean, the court doesn't announce when, but it's likely in June.
Are you familiar with something called TIAA? CREF, is this a teacher's annuity?
Yeah, it's essentially an investment fund for teacher pensions. TIA CREF is how it's referred to.
I'm curious how widely known it is that a member of the Supreme Court sits on between $1 and $5 million in shares of this investment fund, and why does that not cause a question about whether or not this justice should recuse themselves?
That's a good question. I was not aware of it, and so I can't really speak to it. Some judges and some politicians put their investments in blind trusts. Don't know if that's the case here or not, so that would be a good question to ask. Public sector hospitals in the United States tend to focus on low-income communities and communities of color, and this is all around the country. So the people in more impoverished communities depend on these public sector hospitals as their safety net, and so they're going to be directly impacted by this. Again, nurses are speaking out because they want to protect their rights, but they also are speaking out because they want to protect their patients. And in this case, in public sector hospitals, it's if their ability to speak out for their patients is impaired, it really will have a direct impact on the health and safety of the people in these impoverished communities.
For folks out there who want more information about your role in this Supreme Court case, is there a website you might refer them to get more information?
Sure. They can go to www.nationalnursesunited.org.
I've been talking with Ken Zinn from National Nurses United. For more information, you can visit their website at nationalnursesunited.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.
A public hearing on the proposed Tesoro Savage oil terminal in Vancouver along the Columbia River is scheduled for tomorrow in Ridgefield, Washington. The project, if completed, would ship about 360,000 barrels of oil per day, almost half as much crude oil as the entire Keystone XL pipeline. Last week, more than 1,000 people attended the first public hearing on the terminal, most of them opposed. I spoke earlier today with Don Orange, a Vancouver business owner and an opponent of the oil terminal, to learn more.
I am part of Vancouver 101, which is over 100 businesses in the Vancouver area that are steadfastly opposed to this oil terminal project. The oil terminal, as proposed, is going to bring something in the neighborhood of 4 to 8 unit trains, which means trains that are over a mile long, full of explosive crude oil, down our Columbia Gorge to be transferred to a storage facility within about 2 miles of downtown Vancouver, just upwind of us, the potential for explosion, the potential for life lost. The fact that this is yesterday's technology. It is 20th century technology. We have solar firms in Vancouver. We have awesome businesses in Vancouver. We're not going to draw computer companies and solar companies, wind companies, and that sort of thing to a filthy oil town. It is time for us to move on from that. And Vancouver's never been an oil town. This is not Houston. Our team's called the Seahawks. We are not the Oilers. And we're damn proud of it. This is the Evergreen State. We need people from Vancouver, people from Oregon to stand up for the Columbia River, stand up for the Great Northwest. We need to do the right thing for this river this century. And this thing is horrible for business. It's going to cost us jobs. It's going to cost us small companies opening new offices here. We're going to lose, if we lose 1 in 25 businesses that are here, and I mean consulting businesses, engineering firms, computer firms that don't have to be in Vancouver. They just need to be somewhere near an airport and somewhere that is a really nice place to live. If we lose those things, we're going to lose multitudes of jobs compared to the few that this filthy little terminal would, and it's not a little terminal, that this filthy terminal would bring in.
So now there's a public hearing on this Tesoro Savage oil terminal there in Vancouver along the Columbia River. There's a hearing, a public hearing tomorrow, that's Tuesday from 5 to 11 in Ridgefield. Will you be there? Will others from Vancouver 101?
We're going to have a press event at 4:30. I urge anybody that believes in the beautiful Pacific Northwest to come and stand up for it. This is our job. This is we're fortunate to live in one of the most beautiful places in the world, and I urge all people here to stand up and be defenders. We're Oregon used to be known as Pacific Wonderland. It used to say that on our license plates, and we need to keep it that way. We have an obligation to actually improve what we have been handed down to us that's been somewhat degraded by the activities of the 20th century. We have no business using the Columbia River as a pipeline for the filthiest oil in the world. This stuff's coming clear across the Great Divide, looking for places to crash from there to here. This oil company has an awful record on safety for their employees. They have an awful record on the environment. They've been fined over and over again in California and for their Anacortes plant in Washington. And this is our time. This is the Gulf is known for the BP Gulf oil spill. Nobody ever heard of Valdez until there was the Exxon Valdez. There's a number of people, probably most people in the United States, never heard of Vancouver. We do not want to be known for the Tesoro Vancouver disaster. This is a beautiful place, and it's our job to stand up for it.
I've been speaking with Don Orange. He is a business owner in Vancouver, Washington, a part of the Vancouver 101 group of businesses opposed to the Tesoro Savage oil terminal that's being planned for Vancouver along the Columbia River. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News. Tomorrow's hearing will be held from 5 p.m. until 11 p.m. at the Clark County Event Center at the County Fairgrounds in Ridgefield, Washington. A third public hearing is scheduled for Thursday, January 14th at the Center Place Regional Event Center in Spokane Valley, Washington.
The Metro Council meets tomorrow to consider long-term management of the region's garbage. One option they're considering is whether to burn a portion of the region's garbage in an incinerator south of Portland. The burning method would use an existing privately operated incinerator owned by Covanta Energy, which is located just north of Salem in Brooks, Oregon. The incinerator was opened in 1987 and currently burns up to 500 tons of garbage a day, heating boilers that generate up to 13 megawatts a year of electricity. Metro would need to study the environmental impact of incineration before going that route. The study would need to measure the carbon releases from burning the garbage compared with the emissions released from trucking the garbage 150 miles to Arlington. Critics also argue that even with the ultra-fine filters the incinerator uses, harmful and toxic particulates would be released into the air. Metro's current 30-year contract to use the Arlington landfill expires in 2020.
A hearing was held Saturday to gather public testimony on an order of abatement for the Porter Ranch gas leak in Southern California. The order for abatement has the potential to shut down the Aliso Canyon storage facility, the source of the leak. The hearing on Saturday was in response to a petition from the South Coast Air Quality Management District. The petition states that SoCalGas is creating a public nuisance by discharging odor emissions into nearby communities, which started October 23, 2015. Millions of cubic feet of methane and other toxic chemicals, including benzene, which is a known carcinogen, have leaked from the natural gas well. Residents have suffered headaches, nosebleeds, shortness of breath, and nausea. Thousands of residents have left their homes, two schools have been evacuated, and several lawsuits have been filed against the energy company. California Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency last week. SoCalGas engineers said the leak originates far underground and could take as long as 3 more months to fix. After last Saturday's testimony, the 5-member hearing board scheduled another session for next Saturday, January 16th, and will issue an order shortly thereafter.
The trial of Baltimore police officer Caesar Goodson Jr. has been postponed indefinitely after a key prosecution witness requested an injunction to keep from testifying. Officer William G. Porter, whose trial in the death of Freddie Gray ended last month in a mistrial, was ordered to testify against Goodson under a grant of limited immunity.
Porter's attorneys challenged that order and argued in the Court of Appeals that Porter would risk incriminating himself by testifying in spite of the limited immunity. The appeals court issued a temporary injunction on Friday in order to consider Porter's request. Jury selection was scheduled to begin this morning in the trial of Officer Goodson, so prosecutors asked the court to delay the case until the court can decide on whether Porter can be compelled to testify. Trials of two of the other officers charged in Gray's death are scheduled to start in February, and Porter was also expected to testify in those. Meanwhile, Porter's retrial is scheduled to begin in mid-June.
As the occupation at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge enters its 10th day, outsiders continue to flock to remote Harney County in eastern Oregon. Besides the large national news contingent, on Saturday, Oregon Republican Representative Dallas Hurd from Roseburg arrived in Harney County with elected officials from Washington, Idaho, and Nevada in tow to weigh in on the controversy. Also arriving to offer their help was a heavily armed militia group from Idaho, who placed themselves between the occupiers and federal law enforcement, proclaiming they were there to keep the peace and stop a Waco, Texas-type event from occurring. Local community groups in the area have asked Ammon Bundy and the other occupiers to go home, thanking them for publicizing their land use issues but criticizing the occupation. We'll have a full report later this hour with an Oregon journalist who went to the site this past week while researching a book about fascism in the U.S.
A hearing this week in the Oregon Senate Workforce and General Government Committee will introduce state lawmakers to legislation to help prevent wage theft. They'll be considering the legislation when the session begins in February. Recent high-profile wage theft busts on state-funded construction jobs have raised public awareness of the problem in Oregon. KBOO's Demi Hellenius has more on this story in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Some Oregon workers aren't getting paid what they are owed, and at a community hearing in Salem this week, state lawmakers will get a first look at up-and-coming legislation to curb wage theft. Just since Thanksgiving, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, or BOLI, has announced settlements recovering $2.7 million in unpaid wages for construction workers on state-funded projects. But Michael Dale with the Northwest Workers Justice Project says BOLI has less staff and a bigger workload than in the 1990s. He says workers in many fields, particularly in rural Oregon, can't always get the help they need if they aren't being paid fairly or paid at all.
The notion that somehow now problem solved, no, that wage theft continues to be a pervasive and broad problem that needs attention, BOLI needs resources, and private workers need to have the ability to enforce their wage claims themselves.
He says the proposal includes giving workers better access to their payroll records without having to file a lawsuit or a wage claim with BOLI, making it a felony to not pay prevailing wages on jobs, and requiring companies that have had wage theft problems to post bonds. The hearing is Wednesday afternoon in the Senate Workforce and General Government Committee. Dale says wage theft takes many forms, from refusing to pay, to misclassifying workers as independent contractors to keep from paying overtime, to asking people to work extra hours off the clock. He points out that wage theft affects not just individuals, but entire communities.
Nobody spends the money that they didn't get paid in the grocery store. And it's a problem for other employers, because if an employer is trying to do the right thing, they have to compete with people that may not have the same cost structure because they're not paying their workers right, and that's bad for the economy.
He adds, the ideas in draft legislation have had some backing when they've come up before in Salem in different bills and are being combined to help get through the short session in February. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
A KBOO volunteer has been listed as a missing person with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. Nathan Bensky is 20-something, Caucasian with shorter brown hair and dark blue eyes, about 6 feet tall and very slim. Family and friends describe him as approachable and noticeably polite. He was wearing a rust-colored windbreaker when he was last seen on New Year's Eve at his family home on the Willamette River off of Highway 30 between Portland and Scappoose. Family members said that Nate got a ride home from a New Year's party, then went outside for a cigarette following a brief argument. He did not return, though his phone was on for 2 hours afterward, and he left behind his medications. He has an EBT card, which has not been used since his disappearance. Anybody who picked up a person matching Nathan's appearance on Highway 30 in the early morning of January 1st, or who recognizes Nathan, is encouraged to call either the Multnomah County Sheriff at 503-988-4300, Nathan's father, Michael Bensky, at 971-409-7567, or KBOO's front desk at 503-231-8032. A poster, including a picture of Nate, can be found on KBOO's website at kboo.fm.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Alexander Reed Ross, author of Grabbing Back, Essays Against the Global Land Grab. This is followed by Labor Radio at 6, Of the Working Class, By the Working Class, and For the Working Class. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. We'll hear part 3 of With You on the Journey, Families of People in Prison Tell Their Stories. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, News and Views from a Hip-Hop Perspective. Tonight's weather, showers likely, mainly before 10 p.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 40. Tomorrow, rain, mainly after 1 p.m., high near 47. Chance of precipitation is 80%. Today in history, in 1776, Thomas Paine published his pamphlet Common Sense, a work that greatly influenced the authors of the Declaration of Independence. In 1964, U.S. Surgeon General Luther Terry issued the first government report saying tobacco smoking could be hazardous to your health. And in 2002, the first plane load of Al-Qaeda prisoners from Afghanistan arrived at the U.S. military detention camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The quote of the day is from David Bowie. As you get older, the questions come down to about two or three, how long, and what do I do with the time I've got left?
The smell of sweet incense in the air, a skull hanging from a chair. Welcome, my son.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In a faraway land a long time ago, a civilization existed that was governed through a fairly rational political system. Even conservative candidates for high office had to have a good idea or two and be quasi-qualified. That land was the USA. It still exists as a place, but these days, Republican candidates don't even have to be sane, much less qualified, to run for the highest office in the land. All they need is the backing of one or more billionaires, a hot fear-button issue to exploit, and a talent for pandering without shame to the most fanatical clique of know-nothings in their party. Also, they must be able to wall themselves off from reality so that facts and truth cannot deter them. Indeed, the GOP's one great issue of the 2016 campaign is the wall. Ted Cruz practically snarls when he declares again and again that he'll build a wall that works. Marco Rubio is absolute about it. We must secure our physical border with a wall, absolutely. And Donnie Trump has basically built his campaign atop his fantasy of such an imperial edifice. We're going to do a wall, he commands. There are, of course, certain problems that you might expect them to address, such as the exorbitant cost of the thing, the extensive environmental damage it'll do, and the futility of thinking that people aren't clever enough to get around, over, under, or through any wall. But don't hold your breath waiting for any common sense to intrude on their macho posturing. This is Jim Hightower saying, Trump even made a TV ad depicting hordes of marauding Mexicans invading our country, proof that a huge wall is necessary. Only, the film footage he used is not of Mexican migrants, but of Moroccans fleeing into Spain. But after all, when trying to stir up fear of foreigners, what the hell does honesty have to do with it?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments Monday in an important case that threatens to silence the collective voice of teachers and other public sector union workers. Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association is an effort to outlaw fair share fees that workers covered by collective bargaining contracts must pay in return for the bargaining benefits. The right-wing anti-union organization, the Center for Individual Rights, backed in part with the Koch brothers, is behind the Friedrichs case. Eric Hines, president of the California Teachers Association, says this case is another attack against unions with the goal of weakening worker rights and worker political power. He says this case is not really about any free speech rights, as claimed by the plaintiffs.
If you look a little bit deeper and you look at the money that's behind this case, it's the same group of people who have been attacking labor and have been attacking unions in state after state. And in California, they haven't been very successful, so now they're trying this new tactic.
If the union loses the Friedrichs case, public unions nationwide could take a serious funding hit.
It is a completely political act. All voters need to start educating themselves about what these attacks are really about and who's behind them and the money behind them and what happens when we don't win these attacks. They need to vote. There's more of us than there is of them. And the only way that they can really do is if they continue to manipulate us into voting against our own self-interest. Ultimately, we have a stronger power if we choose to engage with each other and express that power as workers.
This is Mitch Lawrence of the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. Are you sitting? Here's the story of a professional athlete who didn't make a money grab, if you can believe that. Dallas Cowboys Sean Lee could have made an easy $2 million when his team played Washington in the season finale. All he needed to do was play 29 plays on defense from his linebacker position, and he would have ended up playing in 80% of the defensive plays for the season. And according to the terms of his contract with the Cowboys, he then would have qualified for a $2 million bonus. But Sean Lee was hobbled by a hamstring injury and decided against playing when he tested the leg in pregame warmups. So he sat out the game and he passed on the money. When it comes to pro football players, that might have been a first. Lee is one of the NFL's top linebackers and has a contract that pays him a guaranteed $16 million, so he's already got a lot of money coming to him. But let's be honest, pro football players ordinarily are not walking away from $2 million, not when their career can be over in the blink of an eye. Except Sean Lee did. As he said, the Cowboys did not pressure him to sit. He made the decision on his own, as he put it, because he was not going to disrespect his coaches and not play the right way. We always hear about greedy athletes in pro sports, but Sean Lee isn't one. So from our perspective, 2016 is off to a flying start.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Immigrant rights groups, along with labor, faith, families, and members of Congress, held a news conference in front of the White House. They demanded that the Obama administration immediately put an end to the immigration raids that have stepped up significantly over the past 2 weeks. For more, KBOO reporter Jenka Soderberg spoke with Reverend Noel Anderson with the World Church Service.
I joined many of immigrants' rights groups as well as in some sort representing the hundreds of faith communities that are part of the sanctuary movement that are either supporting or those congregations that are offering sanctuary to people who have final deportation orders but really shouldn't be deported. And so we are calling on the president from a moral framework to stop these raids because we are seeing how it's devastating the community and how it's creating panic and fear and terror in the lives of our neighbors. And we believe we are called by our faith to speak out against these unjust, inhumane policies that the administration is putting forward without any clear reason why they've decided to make these raids. Now, we know that these are Central American families, many of them mothers and children, that are fleeing extreme violence. El Salvador has the highest murder rate in the world right now, and the gang violence has gotten too extreme for the threats are facing that their families are facing are too much. They've seen their family members die, and we're sending these people back into harm's way who very well could find themselves victims to the same violence they were fleeing. Are we, as a country, as a people, are we willing to say that we can deport people back to their potential deaths? Well, from a faith perspective, we know that the answer is no. We must accept those who are in need, who are most vulnerable, and that's what our congregations are calling on the administration to do.
And I understand the president announced that this wave of raids would take place just before Christmas, and that these raids have begun in force over the last week or so?
That's correct. We first learned of this on December 23rd, and we were having conversations with our sanctuary leaders. Pastors were putting together quotes on Christmas Eve after their services. And we put out a statement on Christmas Day recalling the fact that many of us from the Christian tradition are celebrating a prophet who was born in a stable and had to flee to Egypt with the Holy Family being a refugee family on that in that period, fleeing the violence that Herod, the political violence was that was ensuing. And so we recognize our own history of coming from people who are fleeing, in the case of Genesis, fleeing slavery, and the case of the Holy Family, fleeing persecution and violence. And we believe that our role as not only as people of faith, but also as Americans, is to accept those and welcome those people in who need our need our help at this moment, and not to turn them away, and certainly not to turn them back to what could be a potential death sentence.
Now, here in Portland, in 2014, we had a church, Augustana Lutheran Church, that became a sanctuary for the family of Francisco Aguirre, who was threatened with deportation, ended up living at the church for several months. Is that something that other immigrants are prepared to do, and are there churches that are willing to offer that?
Yes, definitely. In Oregon and in other states throughout the country, I'm hearing of more congregations that are, you know, and that are first joining, supporting. We had a petition where we saw almost 250 new congregations want to support this sanctuary movement. And then we're also seeing more, and of course there is a voting process most congregations have where they take this decision to their church council or to their congregational body and are voting on whether or not they would be willing to do what St. Augustina did and allow somebody to live while they fight in their congregation, in their sanctuary, while they fight their deportation order. In the case of Francisco, his deportation order was withdrawn. Unfortunately, the district attorney had decided to prosecute for unlawful reentry and for something that happened 16 years ago. And so we are, or more now, I'm sure, and so we are pressing hard with Francisco and the community back against that, with the DA, to say Francisco should live here with his community, with his family that he has built. He is part of the fabric of the community. And we have won 10 immigration cases through the sanctuary movement where we've been able to help people get a stay of removal. And you know, depending on each case, sometimes they apply for a U visa, sometimes they apply for asylum. I just heard of a case today in Reno, actually, another case that we won, and I'm sure there'll be more news about that. Help a congregation helping someone get a stay of removal and pressing ICE to do the right thing.
Is that us? I don't have my...
A Muslim woman attending a Donald Trump rally in South Carolina was forcefully removed after standing in silent protest to Trump's anti-Muslim statements. Rose Hamid, a 55-year-old flight attendant, attended the rally with several of the protesters, all wearing shirts that said, "Stop Islamophobia." When Trump said that all refugees from Syria were ISIS supporters, Ms. Hamid and the others in her group stood in protest. Security for Trump's campaign quickly and forcefully ejected the protesters as the crowd chanted and yelled anti-Islamic epithets. The Council on American Islamic Relations demanded an apology, but Trump responded by saying, quote, "It's their hatred, not ours." With the first primaries less than 1 month away, Trump continues to lead the Republican field by double digits. While Ted Cruz, the U.S. Senator from Texas, is ahead in Iowa, Trump has leads in most of the states holding primaries in early February.
Iconic rock star David Bowie has died of cancer at the age of 69. Bowie died yesterday at his home in New York City, surrounded by family, after an 18-month-long battle with cancer. Born in London, Bowie rose to international fame, sold more than 140 million albums, and was named as one of the 100 greatest rock artists of all time by Rolling Stone magazine.
Mexico is considering an extradition request from the U.S. for drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who was arrested Friday. The extradition process could take a year or more. Guzman, the leader of the Sinaloa cartel, had escaped from a Mexican prison 6 months ago. For more information, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Adam Isaacson, a senior associate for regional security policy at the Washington Office on Latin America.
If the past is any guide, capturing Joaquin El Chapo Guzman is not going to have any impact at all on the supplies of drugs coming to the United States. The takedown of Pablo Escobar and the guys in the Cali cartel in Colombia in the 1990s had zero impact. The last two times Joaquin Guzman was captured in 1993 and in 2014 had no impact on availability. In fact, to some extent, it might democratize the trade a little bit more. He doesn't have a monopoly on the drug trade, but he has a lot of market share, and now that market share could be up for grabs, and there could be a lot more people trying to peddle it and trying to get it across the border into the United States. So we're not likely to see any impact on price, purity, availability on U.S. streets.
In terms of the impact in Mexico, if Chapo Guzman's power is actually diminished by this new arrest, if he's extradited, what will end up happening with the cartel that he's leaving behind?
The most likely scenario is that there could be some fragmenting of this cartel. The Sinaloa cartel controls large amount of the cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin that goes up principally through sort of the western half of the United States, but then they've moved into many U.S. cities as well. That's a very decentralized, fragmented, sort of divided up into cells sort of organization. They've always had a lot of autonomy anyway, but now without sort of the Leviathan, the big boss at the top, there could be an orderly succession. But usually in organized crime, there's not. There could be an internal battle, or there could be some external, some new organized crime organization trying to horn in on their territory. In either of those scenarios, you have violence. The same way in a dangerous neighborhood in the United States, if one gang controls the neighborhood and then the cops come in and arrest the top leaders of that gang, quite often what follows over the next several months is a gang war and violence levels go up. You could see that on a national level in Mexico, maybe not in months, but over the next few years.
Guzman is, of course, fighting his extradition. He has been taken in the meantime to the very prison from which he escaped some 6 months ago. What chance is there that the authorities will be able to hold him until the extradition process is completed?
Well, in July of last year, Guzman escaped by having a nearly mile-long tunnel with rails dug all the way from a construction site to his cell. He is a master at tunnel building projects. His organization has dug many of them under the border wall between the United States and Mexico. One way they could start keeping him in the prison, this isn't my joke, but I'll use it. One way they could start is to put him in a second floor cell so he doesn't have that kind of access to the ground. But clearly, Mexico was so deeply embarrassed by the last escape of Guzman, it's likely that perhaps after several months of legal wrangling, he's going to be extradited this time to the United States, something that Mexico had resisted before. And in the meantime, we've already seen pictures of armored personnel carriers and military personnel posted along the perimeter of this prison. I think the security situation is going to be a little different. Last time he was there, reportedly the guards even referred to him as Don Joaquin, which is sort of a respectful way to refer to somebody, he may not get that same treatment now after the deep, deep embarrassment that his last escape caused for Mexico's ruling class. One reason we're seeing all of these Central American migrants coming across Mexico is that smugglers have a very easy time getting across. It manifests itself in so many ways. Guzman's escape was part of that. Hopefully the embarrassment and the huge effort that they had to undergo to capture him again will put them more on a road toward ending this just historic impunity that people who commit crimes and people who are corrupt seem to enjoy in Mexico. You can find more from the Washington Post on Latin America. We have a Mexico program as well as my program, which monitors U.S. Defense and security assistance to Latin America at WOLA.org. And there's a lot of information there.
Well, I've been speaking with Adam Isaacson. He's a senior associate at the Washington Office on Latin America. We've been discussing the capture of Joaquin Chapo Guzman. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News. In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the U.S. Army has announced a plan to send 500 soldiers to Afghanistan for an assignment of up to 9 months. These soldiers will serve as advisors to Afghan national security forces, but will also engage in active combat against both the Taliban and Daesh, known in English by the acronym ISIS. According to information released by the Army, the soldiers will be deployed later this winter to join the 10th Mountain Division at Bagram Airfield after completing a mission rehearsal exercise this month at the Joint Readiness Training Center at Fort Polk, Louisiana. Friday was one of the deadliest days for Taliban fighters in eastern Nangarhar province. Early reports suggested that dozens of fighters were killed in airstrikes, but an Afghan official says that 16 of the casualties were killed in internal clashes between Daesh and the Taliban. At least 43 others were killed by U.S. and Afghan army airstrikes. In Takhar province, Afghan officials report that 17 people were killed in airstrikes. According to the military, the 17 were all Taliban fighters, but this has not been independently confirmed.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imanc.org.